Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, blessed soul, here comes the greatest light. Come ever came to shine, sweeter than the most delectable wine. But until we get that most delectable wine and that sunshine of the Torah from the Most High, we're going to be vibing out for the next, about 27 minutes on Soul Class, 4:30 Secular by Design, Part 25. Greetings and blessings, blessings and greetings. We're alive because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim. Instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim. Instructions of Mercies, we're live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unifying Souls. Actually, our program content will focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, which can be purchased by, just Google up, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. You go to Amazon.com. Our call number is 347-838-8669. And meanwhile, may the Creator bless and protect you and your family peacefully and pleasantly. And joining me on the line is author and faithful Ben Noah and superhuman being with the ability to drive his wife to work this morning and dodge the crocodiles of southern Florida while engaging us in a discussion of his wonderful book. Good morning, Alan. Oh, look over your right side. There might be Crocodile Dundee chasing after you.
Oh, gosh, I just hit one. Oh, well, I needed a new handbag anyway.
Alan, we're going to go quickly right into page 57, Protocols of the Philosopher, the section from Secular by Design, where the last time we were on the radio, on the internet, being heard live around the world, and then hopefully for those who will hear the archive version. We were talking about a Professor Patterson, Professor Orlando Patterson, who wrote a book in 1991 called Freedom in the Making of Western Culture. Basically, as we don't have to recapitulate, because what I'm going to be reading from will clue our reader into where Patterson's mindset was and hopefully isn't now, but let's see where we go with this. So Professor Orlando Patterson's dismissal of the Torah's account of Israel's slavery in Egypt, in which its Egyptian sojourn was retrospectively reinterpreted as slavery. Now, there Alan brings down in footnote 10 from Rav Hirsch, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, in his Collective Writings, Volume 1, pages 39 through 40. And he writes as follows: the foundation of our knowledge of God is the Exodus from Egypt. It is the event that with one blow overthrew the gods of Egypt, the god of Spinoza restriction, the god of Hegelian evolution, as well as the atheism of materialistic narrowness. It is the historical event which, even more than any other, is designated to promoting the understanding of God. Basically, Alan, as I understand it, we're talking about the pure spirituality as it manifests over the materialistic mind, not that we should become angels with wings on the backs of our shoulders and swaddling clothes, meditating on a candle and thinking about what type of wisdoms come from our belly button, but how to make this world a practical vehicle or a conduit for making it as it was originally meant to be, a Garden of Eden for all the human beings of the earth, collectively working as the stewards of the earth. Your take on this?
Well, that's true, and this is relevant to the whole discussion today, talking about in his commentary to Shemot, to Exodus, he talks about Ben Nachor, sons of alien values. What we're discussing in this is Western values, be they theological, be they scientific, so-called, you know, the Western philosophies. These are the Ben Nachor, sons of alien values. And that's one of the things we are having to do, is try to understand that Torah looks at a lot of things differently. It looks at money differently, materialism differently, and everything you can think of. It has pretty much a different spin, a different take on it than the Torah does.
True. Now, Alan, you mentioned that Patterson's dismissal of the Torah's account of Israel's slavery was not a novel new invention of Professor Patterson, or was it just another flavor of replacement theology? Alan, are you there? Alan left the line for a second. We lost him. Hopefully, we'll get him back on. But I'll just continue, bless his souls. That Professor Orlando Patterson's viewpoint on the dismissal of Israel's slavery has its philosophical roots in the retrospective, or I like to call replacement theological interpretation of the Tanakh, which is the five books of Moses, the book of Judges, and the prophets and the writings, say, such as the book of Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Lamentations, the book of Esther, the book of Daniel, and of course Chronicles at the end of the Tanakh. There has been an attempt, and it's worked on those who were uneducated properly in the Torah, whether they be of Jewish origin or of the Gentile nations of the world. And I want to add the blessed Gentiles of the world, because blessed Gentile nations of the world, because all nations have been blessed by virtue of the fact that three ancient sons were blessed coming out of an ark, Ham, Shem, and Japhet. However, Pauline Christianity has been a source of nurturing, unfortunately. I think we're bringing Alan back on. Let's see if we can bring him back on. Yeah, Alan, I have you back on.
Yeah, sorry about that. There's a dead spot on Metro. It's the third time I've lost the signal when I come to that intersection. I apologize.
Okay, no problem, no problem. While you were cut off temporarily, I was mentioning how Pauline Christianity has unfortunately had the undistinguished merit of nurturing all different types of replacement theologies, and as we see in the snippets that you collected from Professor Patterson's book, also he's been affected by it. And along with that, I'd like to just sidewind for one second into a conversation with you, because you know I don't take kindly to this. There are Jews in this world, too many Jews in the world, who are taking this Pauline Christianity line of lying for the sake of what they understand to be the truth. And one such group of mindset is a group that's on Facebook called Key for Peace. And I just want to send this out as a caveat. If they try to befriend you, ask for friendship, please do not befriend them, because they are a missionary group involving Jews with an Edomite, unfortunately, with an Edomite mindset, and also outright Christians who have an intrinsic Edomite mindset, which has to be corrected through the Seven Noahic Commandments. And if you could kind of like connect the dots for us, Alan, and please give your unadulterated viewpoints on Jews who are trying to convert other Jews and other Gentiles towards the Christian religion by using falsehood in the name of truth.
Well, that's been a big problem since Paul and his Hellenists started injecting Gnostic theology into what the Jews of the time were trying to teach. But we'll go into it later in the book, which is a quick thing. This was a big discussion back in Acts, in the New Testament Acts 15. The church, the original Jerusalem church, the Jews who were Torah observant, it's very clear that they were against Paul and his Hellenist gang. Unfortunately, Paul and his Hellenist gang were the ones that won. And this ties into, again, what Hirsch talked about, the Ben Nahor, total prevailing values. The Jews who do this, they are elevating the writings of the New Testament to the level of the Talmud. You know, that is how they interpret the Torah, using those particular writings and not the writings of the sages. There's a lot to go into in this, but it's pretty easy to know if you're following a theological, Christian theological interpretation or a strict rabbinic interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Go
ahead. And in a sentence, what would you say to a Jew who is trying to promote Jesus as the Messiah to other Jews? I'm not going to do a transgression. What shift in consciousness should he make or she make if they are unfortunately stuck in the mud of being a J for J?
Well, the system that I've worked out, and again, you know, especially my first two books, I go into it pretty extensively. They're basing their interpretation on theological, you know, Christian theological. They are putting their faith into writings that have been, I mean, we have so much documented evidence. They have been edited, tampered with, rewritten to the point where they're just not reliable. I mean, you know, you look at all the Torah scrolls going back to whenever, and they are virtually identical. There, in 1,000 Greek copies of the New Testament, there are no two that are the same.
No two that are
identical. And the further back you go, the more differences there are. You know, people say, oh, well, there were different, you know, they had errors in transmission, you know, recopying. But see, it's totally backwards. The early copies are the ones that are so radically different. And as time went on and they had time to smooth them out, you know, they became more the same, although never exact. You know, today you get a Torah scroll, even one that was written, you know, centuries ago, and it's pretty much identical to what we have today. Not so the New Testament. So they are putting their belief system in documents that are just so corrupt, it's a joke.
Right. I just want to mention that I once heard a rabbi who's a professor, I think his name is Rabbi Lauren Schiffman. I think he teaches at NYU, or did teach at NYU. And he said that there are, in the history of the collection of the Sifrei Torah of the Jewish people, there are minute differences in letters, meaning if anyone's out there who understands the Hebrew alphabet, it in one word, is it written with an ayin or a hey? Or is it written, you know, is there an open space or a closed space in Jewish law in terms of how you write the Torah in the original language, the Kasuv Ashori, the Ashurian script, which is an expression of richness, and anyone can see that it is a very, very plush type of writing of the ancient Hebrew, that there was never, in even though there are differences in like letters in how to write the actual Sefer Torah, in terms of the concepts, there have been no changes in the concepts. The only time there was a change in certain concepts is when Ptolemy, who was, I think, before the destruction of the Second Temple, he gathered 70 Jewish sages and sequestered them to 70 different rooms and told them, write for me your Torah, and if there's any changes, then I know it's not the truth. And they all actually distorted certain things in the Torah in order to not insult Ptolemy, or I believe his wife, who had a certain name, which described in the Torah, would have shed something unfavorable about her. So, you know, now let's for the sake of transparency. There the sages were doing it not to try to say that we're going to lie because we're gonna, our Torah is the truth. They were going to do it because they feared for what we would call today in modern terms a pogrom or a massive killing of Jews, if certain things were written, which would have angered the Ptolemy to go on a rampage and kill a lot of Jews. And that's been the problem that Jews have faced throughout the centuries, and especially in the dissemination of the Noahic Commandments up until the 20th century. The Lubavitch Rebbe said, it's time that we Jewish people start informing the Gentile populations of their responsibility. And I want to mention, the Rebbe emphasized, it is the responsibility of the Gentile nations of the world to learn for themselves their responsibility. We'll share with you the information, but ultimately you have to adjudicate for yourself your own societies. Alan, any comment on this?
Yes, the 70 scholars, they translated the Torah into Greek. This is where that document was called the Septuagint, for the up to being 70. But it was a translation and an interpretation. You have to remember that. Onkelos, when he translated the Hebrew Torah to Aramaic, he did some of the same things, like in Devarim 14, where it says, you shall not eat boiled meat, in the milk of a young calf and milk of its mother. He translated that in the Aramaic as, you shall not eat meat with milk. It was a more of a halakhic teaching.
Right.
But that's sort of what they did. Yeah, they changed a few phrases so that the Greeks would not fall into idolatry or get the wrong idea.
Right.
And what is amazing is they all made the same interpretations. Even though they were sequestered apart, their interpretations of that, what they wrote, were all the same.
Right. And that's a very salient point that you brought out, as well as, as an embellishment to what I mentioned, that I do recall there was something, was the name of Ptolemy's wife, I believe, they were afraid that he or she would have been insulted, which could have led to, again, in those days, if a Jew said the wrong thing to the authorities, it wasn't just his life would have been taken, but many lives aside from him. I mean, we see that when Mordechai didn't bow down to Haman in the book of Esther, that then Haman went on upon his program for annihilation of the Jewish people. Thank God it didn't work out, and that's why we have the holiday of Purim. But that's the only thing. I mean, there is no deviation in a Torah scroll for the last 3,300 and almost 27 years, where all of a sudden it became permission, according to Scripture, to eat, like, say, pig meat. These things are constant. I'd like to go into the constancy of Alan Strong's presentation of this issue of replacement theology, which is, as he indicates in Patterson's thesis. The problem with Patterson's thesis is not only how the Christians developed the concept of personal freedom, but why the Jewish concept of freedom was discarded and ignored. Patterson speaks of an individual freedom or individual salvation, a decidedly Christian notion, while commenting that freedom, in fact, was never a central value among the ancient Israelites and Jews. And I just want to add as an asterisk, it was freedom for us is, there is no person who is free except one who engages in God's Torah. But I think, Alan, what's going on here is that this individual salvation or individual freedom is falling upon a mindset that is so hopeless, so lack of trust that things will get better. It's kind of like throwing up in the air and say, well, as John Lennon would say, whatever gets you through the night. Any comment on that?
Well, this is a pattern that we're going to see that I'm going to point out repeatedly in the book. He is coming from a theological Western Christian perspective. Right. And that's how he's treating it. And this book was very influential, as Professor Dudley pointed out. You know, this was like a major work on the topic of freedom. And even though he's a sociologist, of course, you know, it impacts other fields such as philosophy.
Sure.
And, you know, we just have to keep in mind that this person, Professor Patterson, is coming from a Christian theological viewpoint, reinterpreting
sure.
things from that view.
Right. So going further into Alan's book, he mentions that Patterson, Professor Patterson, instead identifies, quote-unquote, the four phases in the development of early Christianity. Here are the following four phases. Number one, the prophetic phase of Jesus and the Jesus movement. Number two, the primitive Palestinian sect, or I like to say the Judean sect. Number three, the Hellenic phase of Jewish and Gentile Christianity, and the culmination of this phase in the religion of Paul. This view presupposes certain variables, namely that Jesus was a prophet, and the Jewish-led Palestinian sect was, in fact, primitive. Thank you, Professor Patterson, for being ethnocentric. Patterson identifies Paul as the high point of creative Christian theology, and that the exception of the Johannine writings, Christian theology would take a downhill course for the next 400 years. So why does Peterson identify Paul as the high point, and why would Christianity take a downfall for the next 400 years, Alan? I'm very, very unfamiliar with these historical points that he's bringing up.
Well, this is an interpretation, of course. It's trying to reinforce the privacy of Paul's writings. You know, without Paul's writings, there would be no Christian theology. So this is a theological teaching in where they're saying that Paul had all these deep spiritual thoughts, and it took the church centuries to figure them out and realize what Paul was really saying. Of course, from my viewpoint, Paul's writings, what the church did was Paul interpretations out of their tuchus, and they wanted to come up with the Virgin Birth, the Trinity, all that stuff. They said, Paul is the one that really knew this, and we're just, now realizing what Paul was saying. You see what I'm saying? They're trying to say that, Paul was this, high spiritual prophet who knew all the answers, and we're just trying. That's not so. Christianity developed, the writings and the theology developed over the centuries. It's really, again, Patterson is making a very clear theological statement. This is a pretty standard theological teaching.
Going further from, as we're going to now pass over from page 57 to page 58, Blessed Souls, as Alan continued, Pauline theology became the basis of Christian theology, which developed over the next 400 years. As the writings of the church fathers show, the problem with looking at the New Testament from this theological perspective, are apparent in Patterson's statements that Jesus' miracles demonstrated his divine powers. Now, let me just go further, ignoring that other prophets had done the same miracles without claiming divinity. In fact, blessed souls, in the Rambam's Laws of the Foundation of the Torah, we see that Rambam says a prophet doing miracles is not the basis for the validity of him being a proper prophet of God. In fact, basically it comes down to if what he says comes true with a positive pronouncement, then you can be assured he's a prophet, or another prophet has confirmed upon him that he is a prophet, or if we should not be dismayed if he makes a negative prophecy and it doesn't come true, because the Creator in his mercies allowed whether it be the Jewish population or the Gentile population to repent, as witnessed in the city of Nineveh. Go to the book of Jonah. So my question to you, Alan, is whether we already know that the era of prophecy had already concluded with the sealing of the book of Chronicles, and Rambam delineates this in the Mishnah Torah with the laws of the Kohanim. So who are they claiming to be prophets that could identify that Jesus was a prophet, or Paul was a prophet, or had prophetic, or Jesus had this divinity because he did miracles. It's, to me, it's such a mishmash.
Well, there's not a single miracle that Jesus supposedly performed that had not been done before. And
that's right.
I don't know. I don't know why they say, why is he divine? Oh, because he did all these miracles. And, I point out, well, look, Elijah raised he brought so-and-so back to life. He fed a bunch of people with
right.
fishes. I mean, every single prophecy or miracle that Jesus did, as far as the prophecy goes, prophet has to be, Rambam, I don't have time to go into that. Too bad your friend isn't here today. He could probably explain it better. But, there's a whole system of how a prophet is recognized. He has to go through the approval of the Sanhedrin, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, the main thing about prophecy, it's knows a prophet, he has to accurately predict future events, which, again, Jesus failed to do on numerous occasions. He made prophecies that were just flat out wrong. So, this is a problem. Again, this is not a rational, Christian theology is not a rational or logical system of thought.
Mm-hmm. With that being said, Alan, I'd like to thank you. I think we had a very sharp half-hour session. We're going to conclude now with David Dome, our blessed brother out in England, who's going to be playing a song called Lord Only Knows. And also I'd like to thank David Dome for coming out and alerting other people on Facebook. Again, there is a website, there's a Facebook page or group called Key to Peace. Please do not join it. These are Jews and Gentiles trying to missionize Jews and Gentiles to adhere to the Christian faith. And I want to make a caveat. For those who are Christians, I as a Jew am not coming to take you away. If you want to believe in that, it's really not of concern to me at a certain level, because that's between you and God. But I will advocate to you and remind you of your obligation to engage in knowing the Torah as it is originally presented with the oral Torah traditions, as it is reflected via the seven universal commandments. Alan, anything you'd like to mention as a practical piece of advice that people can implement this day concerning the matters we've talked about today, or any other issue you think is of importance for our listeners to hear?
Well, again, for the Christian audience out there, I think you need to really be able to study, understand that there's a huge difference between the writings of the Torah and the writings of the New Testament. And to a lot of them say, they talk about the Talmud being that's just a bunch of rabbinic interpretations and teachings. Well, what is the writings of the New Testament? What is theology? You have to think about that. This is a system of interpretation. It's not the word Hashem itself. I think they need to go back and sort of look at it with a bit of fresh eyes or from a different angle.
Thank you, Alan, thank you for your comments. And again, I felt this was a very sharp session this morning. Hopefully we'll reunite next week. I just want to mention last week, blessed souls, my father was hospitalized, and now he's in a rehab. He had a severe case of cellulitis. Things almost got to the stage of touch and go with him. I thank Hashem publicly, and one of the ways of expressing my appreciation is to share programs like this with such a wise human being as Alan W. Cecil. We're playing now Lord Only Knows by David Dome. I hope he comes back home to make us realize that we have to internalize that our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Our divine image will help us get off in scrimmage in the game of life. And don't feel bad if you have some ambivalence about whether you should do good at this very moment, because the Tevah Heitiv, it's the nature of the good to do good, and the Creator's source of all goodness is embedded within you, the greatest bracha possibly that you can bestow, or more than any bracha that you can bestow on anyone else, a blessing. He's given you life, so choose life, and Lord only knows how you can use it for good to make this a sustainable world for 7 billion plus members of the human family experience. Take care, everyone. I'm so tired.
goodbye, our goodbye. Somehow, Lord, oh, no. Yeah.